I've come across many people who see relationships just about the here and now. They are very friendly to someone while they're, you know, directly working with them, or they can get something out of them, or they can do a deal. And as soon as that necessity disappears, then the relationship disappears.
Hello and welcome to the podcast, 10 Lessons It Took Me 50 Years to Learn, where we talk to inspirational leaders from all over the world to dispense wisdom for life, business, and career in order to provide you shortcuts to excellence. My name is Jeffrey Wang, the founder of Professional Development Forum and your host today. This podcast is sponsored by the Professional Development Forum, which helps diverse young professionals of any age find fulfillment in the modern workplace. Today, we're joined by former news director, Jim Carroll. Jim is one of Australia's most experienced media executives, having been the long-serving director of news and current affairs at both SBS and Network 10. And he also held senior roles at Nine and Seven Networks. He has led editorial strategy and news teams for more than three decades and traveled extensively to cover major international stories, including a period heading up Seven's European Bureau. Jim has worked across all platforms, starting his career in newspapers, moving to radio, then television and digital. He left journalism for several years to work as a senior advisor to the former New South Wales Premier Barry Unsworth. Jim is a director of the Australian Science Media Centre and a former member of the Australia Day Council in New South Wales. Jim holds a degree in economics and is a graduate and member of the Australian Institute of Company Directors. I've had the pleasure of meeting Jim as he's a director of Judith Nielsen's Institute's Community Voices program, which seeks to give underrepresented Australians a greater voice in our national conversation, of which I'm fortunate to be a participant. Thank you for joining us today, Jim.
Jeff, really appreciate the opportunity. Nice to see you again.
So that's just jump straight into it then. Lesson number one, play to your strength and know your limitations.
Yeah, look, you know, I guess a lot of these are going to sound pretty obvious, but I guess it's sort of getting below the layers. Yeah, let's be honest, there aren't too many shrieking violets in media. I'm not going to name names just yet. I don't want to get sued. But yeah, there are those that would trample over their grandmother to get in front of a camera or a microphone. But for every person that makes it in front of that camera, there are thousands that aspire to be there. I realized pretty early on that there were people that were better than me in those kind of prominent personality-based roles. And also, it wasn't really what I wanted to do. You know, I was actually quite a reserved kid growing up, but I did like the media and I did like storytelling. And what I discovered quite early was that I was actually pretty good at the process of news gathering, managing the process and getting other people to perform in delivering their stories. And I liked it. And it was a hell of a lot more secure than, you know, actually the other side. Stuff with the camera, because people come and go. But you know, if you're half decent at the management side, then you tended to thrive. And you know, the fact that I survived in a pretty cutthroat business for 40 years, very few of those have 40-year careers on the other side of the camera. So knowing your limitations is reflected by understanding that as a leader, you also can't do it all. The best CEO I work with, you know, look, he had his flaws, but what I noticed about him is that he built a team of experts in their divisional responsibilities, but who were also really supportive of each other and got on well as a group. And that CEO would primarily focus his attention on the areas that he knew were his core strengths, where he had come from. So he was out of the sales area. So he didn't delve too much into the news space or the legal space, but because he was so strong in sales and marketing, that's where he continued to make his strongest contribution while still maintaining an oversight of the entire business. And if you stuffed up, he would pull you into line. So I just thought he was very effective at managing that process. And maybe he was fortunate because he had the right team at the right time. And that business was incredibly successful. It became the most profitable media business in Australia, despite the fact that it was much smaller in numbers terms and in staff terms than any other. But it was the most profitable business for quite a few years. Alternatively, I've also seen leaders who thought they could do it all. I mean, there's a great story about a particular CEO who was very short-lived at one of the networks, who would even go as far as sitting in the edit suite while they were cutting promos for the network. And you're going, I think he had more valuable things to spend his time on. But apparently you could never get him to make a big decision about anything, but he's in there helping an editor cut a promo for programs coming up on air. So I think it's a danger of thinking you have to be all things to all people, as opposed to pulling a team together that are subject matter experts that will work together from a broader strategic perspective, but also be the best operators available in their specific area of expertise.
And so how does one become aware of what their strengths and limitations are?
As I said about myself, I mean, hopefully people are self-aware enough. Although, you know, when you watch some of those talent shows, you wonder why, you know, that person's parents let them go and sing on The Voice or Australian Idol or any of those programs. I mean, sometimes there is a lack of self-awareness. But look, I think it is the self-aware people that get to that level in most cases. Even if some of those people that you thought were self-aware do start to think they can do it all, I think it is a case of trying to bring those people back into line. And that's not easy, but you would hope that at a board level, they would be conscious of it. But I think also if you're dealing as an executive committee, as an ex-com, hopefully there are appropriate and open relationships there where you can have those kind of discussions and you can push back. You know, if someone is intruding into your area of responsibility, now I've certainly had cases of that, but I've got to say it was probably more in the latter stages of my career where you're kind of pretty comfortable with yourself. You know, you're not thinking about the next promotion and, you know, you can push back and your boss say, well, mate, I don't think that's the right way to go. And look, certainly, that's happened on occasions where, you know, a particular CEO was very passionate about particular issues and wanted to take angles on particular issues, but you have to push back. If you just surround yourself with yes people, you're only going to be told what you want to hear. And that is not a great recipe for business success.
I agree with that. And that sounds like a great segue for lesson number two, building alliances and maintaining relationships. I think you alluded to this earlier.
Yeah. Look, I guess everything kind of interweaves. And it seems pretty obvious and everyone talks about it, I think, at a senior level, but it's also in the doing. It's not just talking about it. And I've come across many people who see relationships just about the here and now. You know, that they are very friendly to someone while they're, you know, directly working with them, or they can get something out of them, or they can do a deal, and, you know, they're inviting them on the golf course and, you know, and inviting them out to lavish dinners. And as soon as that necessity disappears, then the relationship disappears. Whereas I think, Jeff, you've probably experienced this, you know, with me, that through Community Voices, that I'm being very focused on maintaining relationships. It's very important, not just for what you can get out of them, but, you know, I think as a person, I think you become a stronger individual if you work hard at relationships and you build. You know, they don't necessarily have to be friendships; they can be professional relationships. But where they can be both, that can be a really good thing. And as we were talking about earlier, if you have that kind of relationship with your CEO or your COO, and you can say, "Mate, hang on a bit, I don't think you're heading in the right direction," and you can have those robust conversations. As I said, I think it's a lot easier when you're at the end of your career, as opposed to, yeah, I hope the boss doesn't fire me for pushing back so heavily. But I think it's something that you need to be very conscious of. And look, I've never seen a relationship just for a particular purpose as something that I would think about. I have ongoing close relationships and friendships with people that I met 40 years ago, 30 years ago, 20 years ago. And some of my best friends were when I worked in politics in the 80s and at Channel 10 and Channel 9. I think strong relationships form when you're in the trenches together. Mm-hmm. And you know, Jeff, I know you'd be aware of this. In politics, there is probably no more, you know, robust battles than those that exist in politics. And you do feel under siege. And certainly in the period that I worked in politics, the particular government was under very heavy pressure. So there is a bit of that siege mentality where, you know, you're kind of in this together, and that does, I think, form very close bonds. But the fact that those bonds continue to exist, you know, 30, 33 years later, I think it's a really good sign, but you do have to work at it. And, you know, those, yeah, they are people that you can call when you've got a challenge, when you need advice, You may not still be in the same workplace, but you want to be able to do that. You know, if you're going to call up someone for a favor, someone that is going to present at Community Voices and give some great insights to people like you, the fact that you've got those relationships and that you've worked hard on those relationships and that it's a two-way situation, then it's a good thing. So, yep, people you work well together with because you saw and shared a common purpose are the ones that you want to maintain those relationships with. And importantly, you want to choose people that will also want to support you and you want to support them. Let's be honest, you need allies to help you do a job, to help you keep a job, and to even get a job. Not too many jobs come through classifieds anymore. I think the vast majority of jobs, particularly at a senior level, is through relationships, through someone saying, gee, I know that Jeffrey Wang, he's a really good guy, really good at his job, really good at relationships, really works well with people. That is worth $1 million in terms of the recruitment process.
And I can see the impact that you had on the people that you've known over the years as well. I mean, through even the Community Voices program, marching into Q&A the first night, the first thing I saw was, hey, Hamish McDonald coming up to you saying, hi, Jim. And that is just a testament to how well we treated people that you've worked with in the past. And if I recall correctly, you also gave Hamish a job earlier on in his career as well. So that certainly is a testament to how well you treat the people that you come across. And clearly over the years, you guys stay close and have a very strong bond. But I also like to add that, you know, it's not just for careers. In life, you need these relationships. And you know, we are relational creatures. I do believe a big part of our well-being and happiness relies on the quality of the relationship we have with those people around us, those people that's close to us. And so that's certainly something of great consideration as well. All right, moving on to lesson number three, be decisive and organized. Now, I would have thought that that would be a given. What do you mean by that?
Well, do you think it is, Jeff? Do you think it is? I've worked in a lot of places that people aren't organized, even people at the most senior level, and actually trying to get a decision out of senior leadership, let alone middle management, can be incredibly difficult.
Why is that, do you think? Why are people having such difficulty making these decisions, knowing that they have to be made timely?
Yeah, look, I think it's about people being wary of taking responsibility if things go bad. As I've been a big believer that, you know, an occasional bad decision is better than no decision at all. I've seen many situations, you know, particularly in the public sector where there's so much consultation, you end up with an ineffective mishmash as a final outcome. You know, I think the reality is too many people are reluctant to take responsibility for making a tough call, overly anxious about the potential negative repercussions, I suppose, upsetting people if it goes bad, as we've talked about before, damaging career prospects when they might be in mid-career. I don't think I've been afraid of making decisions, and, you know, which I hope is a key reason why I've kind of stayed in leadership roles for a long period of time. And I guess I was identified as, you know, as a 21-year-old saying, well, he's a bloke who can make a decision about things. Let's put him in charge. And you know, that was leading journalists who were, you know, 15, 20, 30 years older than me. But there was no real pushback on that. I think they just said, oh, here's a kid who could actually, you know, make the calls on things. It was leading people who weren't natural decision makers, who were there to do a task, and they were quite happy. They saw that as their role, was to go out and report on stories. And that was their preference. They didn't want to make the decision about which stories to cover or which order those stories ran. They just wanted to go out and do the stories. And I guess maybe that was just the stars aligning at that particular time where I was the guy prepared to say, well, why don't we do this? And it's much easier for people just to agree with something than to come up with themselves or to make the ultimate decision on it.
What makes you particularly good at making these decisions? Is it because you're just better at envisioning what would be a good story to run? Is it because you've just got a good instinct, or is it a bit more of a dark art? Is it just because if you decide, people just go along with it? Like, how do you know that you're making the right decisions? And is there a framework?
Oh, do you ever know if you're making the right decisions? until you see the outcome. But I think it's probably a combination of all those things. You know, I don't think I was an overconfident person, but I always felt that I was a thoughtful person and a considered person. But I also believe that you couldn't prevaricate. You really had to make a call on things. And, you know, in some cases, this is putting people's lives at risk if you're sending someone into a dangerous situation. But, you know, you consider all the safety and security factors. But you can spend so much time doing that that the decision, the requirement for the decision is almost passed. So I think if you're given the responsibility, and that's what I got, I guess I was given at a fairly early age. If I was given the responsibility, I took up that responsibility. If you're given the responsibility, you have to take a hold of it because you are given charge to lead. And if you don't do that, don't take the job. And particularly, you saw this in media because they were high-profile journalists or broken particular stories, that they moved them into management roles. And some of them were not very good because that wasn't their skill set. Their skill set was going and doing a great story. Making a decision about to assign that story or making a decision about how that story will ultimately be placed on your news platforms or making decisions about the promotion for that story, that's not necessarily their strengths. If you're the best journalist around, then be a journalist at the age of 60. If you are an average journalist at 25, or that's not your passion, but you're really good at some other aspect of the business that you're in, then follow that path. It may not be as glamorous. You may not go to as many exciting parties, Jeff, but you're going to get a better outcome as a result. I got better in the latter stages of my career. I think I made better decisions, but you'd hope that. You hope that with more experience, you make better decisions. You are more willing to make tougher calls when your job isn't under threat as a consequence of those calls. And yeah, I made mistakes. I'm sure there are plenty of people I've worked with over the years that said I made terrible calls on things or I employed terrible people. We all make mistakes. I've made the wrong call on covering stories sometimes. Have I appointed the wrong people? Sure. But in the end, someone has to make the call and to succeed, both as the decision maker and for the best interest of your organization, you have to do that. Someone has to do it.
And I do think that there is an element of people willing to take that responsibility as well. I mean, I do see too many managers, and I use managers as opposed to the word leader, who is more interested in the status and the position of the job rather than the responsibility of the job, which is to take the responsibility for the decisions they make, which makes a great segue to lesson number four, present strategic options and argue for your preferred position. So again, it sounds like something that you would think everyone should be doing this.
Yeah. Well, my experience is, Jeff, that you're not that likely to get great ideas coming from boards. Plenty of directors will provide, I guess, valuable insights on the strategic direction. I guess that's their job. You know, that they are not there to create the strategy, but yeah, they are there to assess and decide upon the strategy. But to be honest, I've been pretty shocked at times with how little directors know about the business that they're actually a part of. I remember this was many years ago. I was in a board meeting and I remember a particular director lived in Sydney, and he was saying that the network should do a program like the Rugby League Footy Show because this network had the AFL. And said, we should do an AFL type footy show. And then it didn't need to be pointed out to him that another network had been running the AFL footy show for about 20 years, and it was one of the highest rating, most awarded programs. But this person, who was a director of a TV network, did not know that. And more recently, there was a director who was a newish director and was being shown around the newsroom, being introduced to staff. And he asked the primetime news presenter, he'd been in the job for quite a few years, what this person did. He was a director who had not actually watched the most significant and important program on the network on which they were on the board.
Wow.
So you're going, wow. But, you know, they make their contributions in other ways. You don't necessarily need to have them watch the news every night, but you would hope that they would have a depth of understanding about the business. The point is, don't expect too much inspiration from directors. If you get it, that's great. Look, I think my experience with executive teams is that, you know, each executive tends to have their level of expertise in their area of divisional responsibilities. You know, I was the news guy, so hopefully I knew a lot about news and current affairs. I would always like people to have a view about the product. I'd hope that they watch the product. Sometimes it concerned me that other executives didn't tend to watch the product that you were making and yet would have a view. Sometimes that you are in this kind of position of isolation, that you are dealing with fellow executives and directors who actually don't know that much about what you're doing. They may not have even watched what you're doing, even though it's important, but will have a view on it, Jeff. They will still have a view on it, even though they haven't actually watched it. So
what you're really saying is that the knowledge or the good idea should come from the floor and go all the way up, and you should have the courage to argue for that.
Yeah, that's right.
Now, what you're saying also is that you should argue for your preferred position. So why is it so important that you settle on that particular recommendation?
Maybe I'm being a bit too subtle there. I mean, you've got one outcome you want to achieve, but you've got to ensure that there are other options there. You put all your focus on the option that you want them to support, but you need to ensure that there are other alternatives there. Because otherwise I think, he's just trying to bluff me. He's just trying to bulldoze this thing through. There's a bit of subtlety around that. It presents strategic options and argue your preferred position. Of course you're going to do that. But within each of those, it's that nuance. It's understanding who you're dealing with and what their expectation is. The board expectation is that they want to make an easy decision. They don't want to make the right decision. They want to have enough input to show that they are interested and contributing. And I think if you can give them an opportunity to do that, then everyone will leave satisfied. And I think, you know, as I talked about that previous CEO, we've got a really good executive committee together that were not only strong in their own areas, but knew a lot about the business more broadly. And I think that's the sweet spot. If you can get that, because what will happen then is that if you've got a cohesive executive committee, they will support you. You know, if you've built those relationships with your fellow executives, even though they may not necessarily know much about what your plan is, and you will just have that kind of sweeping overview, if you can get them to support you, you are 99% of the way there. So it's, you know, it's relationships helping you get the best strategic option delivered by the executive committee and ultimately by the board.
Sounds like what you're doing is to show them that you present them with a option that is clearly thought out and well considered. What you're effectively doing is to make it easy for them to take that particular recommendation and show that they've contributed. So that's a great insight in there.
Almost giving them no choice. You want them thinking that's a no-brainer. There is no other direction to go. Even though he's presented some other options, that makes 100% sense.
Brilliant. And that's, you know, that's almost basically goes for a sales pitch as well when you're putting something forward. So that's great. That's a great segue, actually. No, it's not.
It's a terrible segue, this one.
Terrible segue to the next one. But I love this lesson. Show me how good you are. Don't tell me.
Mm. Yeah,
I know exactly who you're referring to here, but go on.
Well, you know, Jeff, I might sound a bit like a grumpy old boss that, you know, things were so much better in the old days. But look, I will be honest, I was kind of stagnant in the latter stages of my career with the kind of growing expectations of small numbers of staff. You know, not majority. I think most people are great and feel that they will be rewarded at an appropriate time. But there is this kind of small number of staff who, you kind of feel entitled to promotions and opportunities they hadn't earned at that stage through their performance or the contributions that they're making. I think these are the people who tend to suck out a lot of the oxygen from the room. They occupy a huge amount of managerial time, of human resource time, probably more than the rest of the team combined. The business becomes about serving them and their aspirations, rather than the audience and the customer. The business exists for the audience, you know, media, it exists for the audience. Yeah, you want your staff well satisfied in the role that they're doing and given opportunities, but they need to earn that. Occasionally people will slip through, and we'll talk about that in the next point. But, you know, maybe it's a reflection of a different generation, and, you know, a generation that's more confident about getting their way and getting their way quickly. You know, they see people achieving at an early age. I guess, you know, I was put in responsible roles at an early age, but it wasn't by me berating a boss saying, well, why aren't I in this job? Can I go overseas to Paris to cover the Olympics? Being more confident is actually a positive thing, you know, and you want people to have that ideal combination of actually showing how good they are and being confident to say, look, I've done this great work. Hopefully you as a manager have noticed that great work and have got them on that path anyway. but they need to deserve it. They need to earn it to prove that that promotion or that opportunity should be, that it should happen. And I guess that brings me to the next point, Jeff. You want me to do a natural flow into the next one?
Well, no, I don't, because I'm going to pull you up on this one.
Okay.
So this particular one, now, you're not going to get any disagreement from me. I absolutely believe in the old values of just heads down, bum up, and do the work and get recognition. But I'm going to play the devil's advocate here, and that is the fact that you don't seem to get very far in your career, at least in the Western context, unless you know how to promote yourself within the workplace. So you realize that this concept of a personal brand, which is really going out and telling everyone what a great job you've done. So clearly this lesson resonates with me, because it kind of is in line with my philosophy being brought up in the Asian world, where you don't go out and tell everyone how good you are. You show them by putting in the hard yards, right? So fundamentally, I believe in that. However, that hasn't transpired much in the Western world where I spent most of my working career, because it doesn't seem to get you the recognition that you need. I mean, it is a very noisy place out there, and clearly there's a whole lot of peacocks out there, which I'm sure you know what I mean when I say peacocks.
Yeah.
And these are the people that goes around and they will tell you everything about how wonderful they are, and yet they don't necessarily have the substance to back up the sales pitch. So here's the question to you. When the workplace rewards this sort of behavior, how do you tell people to do the hard yards?
Yeah. Look, self-promotion in itself is not a bad thing. All I'm saying is, with that self-promotion, there's got to be substance there. And I think people who self-promote but don't have the substance, don't have the record, don't have the capability, they get found out. It's certainly my experience is that they will ultimately get found out. I think we all talk about, oh, he's a fraud and She's hopeless. Boy, they're good at managing up. I love that expression. Was it kiss up, kick down? Certainly through my long career, I've seen plenty of show ponies, but very few of them. Yeah, they may prance around looking good for a little while, but ultimately, in the end, they end up at the knacker's yard. I can understand your pain that you may have experienced. That hasn't necessarily happened in some cases. And sure, there are people who I've seen continue to rise and I'm amazed. But I think in most cases, good people do get the rewards. If they are good people who are confident talking about their achievements and those achievements are substantive, then that's the perfect outcome. And that's why I don't think having a generation that is more confident talking about their achievements and their expectations is a bad thing. What is a bad thing is if it's not true and they don't deserve it. And it's really tough. It's really tough for managers to deal with that, because, as I said, that they can really, that small cohort can be so self-absorbed and so time-consuming. It means that you're not managing the rest of the cohort as effectively as you possibly could. And you are perhaps missing out on that quiet achiever who's doing a great job, but you just don't hear that much about. So it's a double whammy, isn't it? But there's no easy solutions. I think managerial skills have improved. I guess that's one thing I have noticed, that I guess being one of those old school type people, I was always pretty skeptical about, management training techniques and the other kind of the philosophies of business practice. But I think that has really evolved. And I think as a consequence, people are far more astute managers. They are more skilled as managers than I was when I first started out. I mean, I didn't do a business management course. I don't think I ever did a course on how to manage people. For decades, you kind of stumble your way through. And again, I don't like having difficult conversations with people about their careers or underperformance. It's really horrible. It's a horrible thing to have to do. But someone's got to do it. And if you are in that responsibility, as I said before, you've got to take that responsibility and do it in the best way possible. Do it in a way that you can turn people around, that you can build their confidence, that you can build their effectiveness. And if someone got the solution, I don't know, maybe if you go to Harvard or somewhere else, you can do it. But I've seen that, no great evidence that there is a management course that is going to teach you that every technique that you need to make every single one of your staff members happy.
No. And there isn't. It is more of an art form. Sounds like that links on pretty well to lesson number 6, identify talent, promote quickly, and be alert to quiet achievers. Again, something that I absolutely believe in, but I just don't think it's pervasive enough, especially in the Australian workplace.
It does flow on, Jeff. And you need to be across the capabilities and performance of your team, from the lowest level employee, the most junior employee, to your direct reports. You know, and I know that's hard in large businesses. My biggest staff cohort was, I had 300 people. Most recently, it was 180 people. Look, I felt comfortable that I knew every person pretty well across those 180 and what they did. And if I didn't know them well, I knew people who worked with them closely and I knew them well. So you had a real sense that if someone deserved a promotion or someone wasn't performing, you'd be aware of that. I think that's really important. It is time consuming, but as you get into more senior leadership roles, that's absolutely crucial. Look, if someone's good enough, give them the job, give them the promotion, no matter their age, their background, their experience shouldn't be a hindrance. I would have considered myself a pretty quiet guy. You know, I worked hard early in my career. Fortunately, I had bosses who I think were observant enough to notice that I was actually okay at what I did. There were plenty more louder, more brazen people selling themselves. But in the end, I seemed to get most of the pretty good gigs. So fortunate there. And you know, just give a quick example, in my most recent news director's role, there's an incredibly quiet young producer. You just noticed it because she was working in a specific area of news. She was incredibly diligent. Every time her particular segment came up, it was fantastic, really detailed. And she'd worked externally at other media companies. Obviously, other people knew her as well. And she was offered a much higher paying job with another media organization. And I sat her down and I said, look, you may not think that you're getting noticed here, but let me tell you, I notice you. And, you know, she was like a mid to junior level producer. And I said, look, you are doing great work here. And it's people like you that will be the leaders of this business in years to come. And I was able to talk this person around from a $30,000 pay increase, which was a lot of money for someone who, you know, wasn't necessarily on that high salary anyway. We gave her a little pay increase because she was given more responsibility. But you need to know those people within your business.
That's the kind of leader I wish I had more of, especially in my career. So lesson number 7, your best career path may not be what you think.
Yeah, or initially aspire to. Because I was able to make, you know, pretty impartial assessments of my own shortcomings and hopefully strengths, and then make a cogent career choice that was probably, you know, a little bit removed from where I thought I'd be. I thought, well, yeah, maybe I'll be a star journalist, or, you know, I didn't think that for very long. But again, I realized that there were people not only better than me, but much more determined to achieve that than me. Whereas, you know, going back to my original point, I was actually pretty good at other things that they weren't good at. And I guess because I was pretty good at having that self-assessment, I think it made me a pretty reasonable judge of other people's talents and capabilities. I saw a core responsibility as a leader and people manager was to kind of help staff focus on what they're best at and where their best career opportunities lie. Even if it wasn't their favorite path, but, you know, they might have wanted to be someone in front of the camera reporting, but you had those conversations. So, look, you're pretty good at that, but you are fantastic at this. And you realize on that other path, there are tens of thousands of people who want to do that. And of those tens of thousands, only one of them is going to end up reading the news. Whereas there is always a demand for high caliber people who can manage this business. That's where the longevity is. It's exciting. You're making decisions about things. You're making decisions about talent, about resources. And if that's of any interest to you, have a think about that. It wasn't like, look, you're not that good as a reporter, go and do this. It was, this is where I think you could have a hugely successful career. Would you like to think about that as the option? Very happy to have you doing your current role, but I reckon you can move much more quickly up this path by following this guidance, by following this map. And I'm pretty proud of my record in that space, that I've been able to do that. And usually those people have been immensely satisfied with the new direction in which they've taken themselves.
Definitely. That is great and incredibly valuable advice from a mentor. Lesson number 8, listen widely. And again, this is, I'd imagine the news business, listen widely means that you don't miss the stories that people aren't covering. Now, we've had a journalist before in this podcast, Matt Bai, who gave us one of his lessons is look away from the ball. In a ball game, everyone's focused on what the ball is doing.
Yeah,
but sometimes the real story is actually completely away from the ball. I'm guessing this is probably one of those lessons.
Yeah, look, it is. It did surprise me. I've done hundreds and hundreds of job interviews. You know, people aspiring to come into the media business who just aren't aware of what's going on around them in terms of the news space. In the last couple of years, you know, these are some of the best young minds coming out of communications courses, want to be journalists. And, you know, these are people that we've shortlisted down from 400 applicants to the top 25. And one of them seriously said, when we asked them who the Queensland Premier was, she said, oh, it isn't Pauline Hanson, is it? And you're going, really? and yet, you know, their intent is to be a source of credible information to audiences. So it is that kind of lack of preparedness that I found staggering. And yet there was a young person a few years back, he'd actually left journalism for a while. I think he'd had some challenges, but he decided to reapply. And he actually didn't make the cut the first time around, but we interviewed him again. And what really impressed us was he actually read the newspapers every day. On his way to work, that's a young person actually buying a newspaper, Jeff. No one knows that before. And he knew more. His general knowledge was better than any of the other cadets that came through. Most of them were actually already working in news. He had moved himself away from the news scene and was working in a completely different role, and yet knew more about day-to-day events and the news that we would be focusing on than any of the others. We ended up giving him a job. We were quite cautious about that, and he has really, really progressed well. In the end, it was a right decision, the one we were nervous about, but he has turned out to be a fantastic, dedicated employee and continues to continue to rise through the ranks. Also about listening is to ensure you're aware of people's capabilities. I guess it comes back to people management as well. You can't always rely on hearsay. You need to listen carefully and be observant to the individual and those that work with and around that individual. So, you know, I guess it comes back to that point before, that you're only going to really know the capabilities of an individual if you either know that directly or that you have faith in those that are giving you advice about that individual. So I think that that's really critical. And also, if you are listening intently and widely, you will hear great ideas. And you know, there is a reluctance, I think, by, you know, certainly those quieter tubes to sometimes push their ideas. If you're listening intently, if you're across everything that's around you, you will hear those ideas, even if they haven't come to you directly. You know, someone will say, oh, you know, so-and-so had this good idea, but he or she's a bit nervous about bringing it to you. I think that's, you know, that's really, really important. Again, it's probably bleedingly obvious, but it needs to be reinforced because everyone's incredibly busy. At the moment, you know, 95% of people are working like this on a screen. You're not engaging. You're not listening around the office. You're not chatting to someone while you're getting a cup of coffee. And I think, you know, it's even more critical if you are conscious that this is a really important part of the process.
So it feels like the entire podcast has been building up to this particular lesson. Lesson number 9, beware of the noisy, self-absorbed few. Yeah. What do you mean by the noisy?
Oh, maybe I was being too harsh, Jeff, when I wrote this one down, you know, it was my stream of consciousness. But look, yeah, you know, it does come back to my point about showing how good you are, not just telling me. But look, small-scale dissent or dissatisfaction may just be a personal gripe or the result of personality clashes. There will always be personality clashes in the office space, you know. But look, I'll be honest, it can be evidence of a broader cultural and managerial problem. So, you know, you have to act quickly on that. But I think, you know, I have seen examples of businesses that have overreacted. Mm. And as a consequence, there has been bad policy. My warning would be not to overact by being too hasty to solve what may be a one-off situation. Such action may be at the potential detriment of the organization and the broader staff cohort, but you need to investigate thoroughly. You need to work patiently through grievances and to speak with all relevant parties. And I think sometimes that doesn't happen. Consider all the evidence, then act. I think I've seen, you know, a little bit of evidence of late, and it is a different environment that we work in, that too often these days, the action seems to become before the full investigation, before you've had a chance to fully assess all the issues. There was an example at one of my workplaces where there was an historic claim of bullying going back more than a decade. And my concern was that it was taken immediately as fact. There was no investigation. There were no interviews with other employees who were there at the time. and certainly no discussion with the, you know, the alleged perpetrator. But the reality was there were different views about that situation, even though it was many years ago. I wasn't there at the time. But the action was taken within 48 hours. Basically, a new policy was devised within 48 hours with a view to it being implemented immediately. And my view was that process was rushed because there was a bit of media attention around at the time. Look, a more considered approach may well have delivered the same outcome in terms of the policy that the employer decided to implement. But the pace of that process left a lot of staff apprehensive and disenfranchised and disillusioned. And you have to consider that. And I would never say to ignore issues, no matter if they appear trivial. You can't underestimate the cultural and reputational impact a lack of necessary action may have, but you have to ensure that the process is correct and fair.
So this sounds like this is a bit of a juicy story, but if I could just replay that back to you and to see if I've got it. So what you're basically saying is that we need to think before we act and basically retain the due process that is required in reacting to serious situations, right? So I'm just thinking in the context of, you know, let's say a social media lynch mob reacting to something, you know, the latest Harvey Weinstein scandal per se, but it's sort of just jumping straight into action. Take some time to stop, reflect, check the facts, investigate before you launch into a full-scale reaction. Is that what you advocate?
Yeah. And, you know, look, that's not to say that prompt action hasn't brought great results in terms of some terrible perpetrators, but I don't think you can group every incident in that basket. And I think, yes, some of those more serious actions by people reduced in terms of their impact by action against less serious issues or non-existent issues. My argument will always be, if you're a lawyer, you've got to look at all the evidence available. If you're a journalist, you don't just write one side of the story. Well, you shouldn't, hopefully, you shouldn't just write one side of the story, although some journalists may be accused of. You take all the information on board and then you write about it. As a lawyer, you take all the information on board. As a judge, you hear all the evidence before you make a ruling. As a jury, you hear all the evidence before making a ruling. That means that you will get the right result, hopefully, in every circumstance. We don't want the right result in some circumstances and not the correct result in others. And nor do we want issues to be underplayed, and we don't want people to be fearful about bringing concerns forward. But you just need to make sure that there is sufficient substance there, I think, before you take significant action.
Yep. And there's certainly, I can see a parallel between, I suppose, the news world as well as the corporate in this particular lesson, in that in the news world, you know, people seem to jump at the bright, shiny news story without necessarily going through the rigor of checking that. So certainly I can see the value of this lesson, not just in the context of workplace issues, but also in search of the truth.
Absolutely. I think you've seen that with some of the coverage of the lockdowns and the pandemic, generally the vaccine rollout. Not that I want to accuse my journalistic brethren of unbalanced stories, but I think some of the stories haven't contained as much balanced information as they perhaps should. But everyone's under pressure. And when people are under pressure, you know, sometimes there's not as much fact checking as normally would be the case.
But I guess in that instance, having the character to withstand that pressure and do the right thing regardless, I believe it is probably the key learning there.
Yeah, but you ultimately want the right thing to happen. It's at the end of the day, if there is evidence there that bad things are happening, then action must be taken. The last thing you want to do is bury it, because culturally that's corporate suicide. But you want to make sure that it's fact-based. Every decision you make in a project, particularly when it relates to people, that it is factually based.
Wise words indeed. That takes us up to lesson number 10. Now, it's hard to disagree with this. Be a decent person.
I know. You know, everyone thinks they're a decent. You know, I think most people think they're decent people. I guess in media and in politics, two sectors with huge egos and high profile individuals. You know, people that are always in the public eye. And I guess what's obvious to me, particularly in the media, is that those that treat others well, invariably seem to be the ones that survive, no matter how high their profile might be at a particular time. If they treat people decently, and that could be as simple as hello to the receptionist on the way in, how was your weekend, that kind of stuff. I know it sounds really simple, but so many people don't do it. And we're all self-absorbed to a degree, but it doesn't take much to be considerate. You know, you're talking about a few seconds of your day. And look, I think those things stick with you. I was going to give you a few examples. One of Australia's best known and longest serving newsreaders. She's pretty tough in the work environment, but it's not about ego with this person. It's about getting the best product to air. If you meet this person 10 years later, 15 years later, she always remembers your partner's name, always remembers your children's names, what they were doing, always shows that level of interest. I think that's an inherent reflection of her decency. A couple of really minor things, but they kind of stick in your mind. There was, you know, a very well-known Melbourne identity who I worked with for a year or so back in the early 90s. He's had his challenges, but still, you know, certainly very well-known. I hadn't seen him maybe for 20 years. We were both at a function together and he came up to me. Again, I wouldn't have thought he would even have recognized me after all these years, and was the most engaging in his chat with me. Obviously knew who I was, introduced his son to me. And I'm going, wow, that's pretty impressive for a guy who's one of the biggest stars in media and in football administration. Similar incident, I was at a sporting event and there was, again, a very high profile, well-known breakfast program host. And again, I'd only worked with him really briefly back in the late 80s. And this was literally 25 years later. And he came over to me, said g'day, and knew my name. And I'm going, that's pretty impressive. You know, that's why 30, 40 years on, this person's still at the top of their game. And I thought that was really quite significant. But one I always remember was when I just left school and I'd started work at a newspaper in Sydney called The Daily Mirror. And I just turned 18 and I was working in the radio room, the police radio room. That's where you listen to all the emergency calls. It was the shit job that all the young staff were given when they first started. And I was on duty on the 18th of January, 1977. And over the police radio, I heard an ambulance call to say that there'd been a rail accident near Granville. And that was the only message that came through for quite some time. And you're pretty nervous when I haven't even been in the job for about 2 months. Anyway, I decided to ring the photographer. That's what you did in those days. You ring the news photographers and they'd go out and suss it out. So they did that. And obviously that turned out to be the Granville train disaster, which was Australia's worst ever rail accident. I think 84 people died as a consequence. But this had happened about just after 8 o'clock. At 9 o'clock, I got this call through to the radio room. And the guy on the end of the line was Steve Liebman. Now, Steve Liebman at that stage was the number one radio announcer in Sydney on 2SM, which was the number one radio station at that time. His audience was about twice what Alan Jones ever got and what Ray Hadley gets. It wasn't his researcher that rang. It wasn't his producer that rang. What Steve had done is he'd rung during the news bulletin. So he had 4 or 5 minutes where he could chat to get the latest on the situation. He'd obviously heard that our guys were the first on the ground there and he rang me to get as much information. Good. And he continued to ring me every half hour during the news segment. So he was fully informed as he went to air after the news. On each occasion, he was incredibly polite and gracious. He's talking to an 18-year-old kid. He's the number one radio star in Sydney, doing all his own work. And I'd kind of put it aside because I was about to finish my shift. And then he rang again at the end of the program and just wanted to thank me for the help that I'd given him. And I was absolutely blown away by that. And I always have remembered that throughout my career. Some 30 years plus later, I actually employed Steve. Steve obviously went on to be the first host of the Today Show, was news presenter on Network 10, one of the most admired media figures in Australia. And I ultimately ended up towards the latter stage of his career, giving him a job reading the weekend news. And then I mentioned that story to him and he was quite moved by that. But he just said, well, isn't that the right thing to do? And you kind of go, that's why this man is respected and had longevity, that, you know, it was the right thing to do. So I just think that kind of epitomizes to me that for all the criticism of people, particularly high profile people, there are inherently decent people and they're considered inherently decent because of the way that they treat others, no matter what level of the organization they're at. So I've always also been a believer that if someone stuffs up, be calm about it. You know, no one feels worse than the person who stuffed up, and no one learns more from stuffing up than the person who's made the mistake. So again, I've never been a shouter, and I think that's the best way to play it to make sure you've got a nice cohesive atmosphere.
So Steve Lehman, he's a decent person. 30 years later, you remember him. Absolutely agree with that. I certainly hope that there will be plenty of decent people as a result of listening to this podcast and make the world just a little bit better. Now, my favorite question, as we all do, we throw our guests a great curveball. What is the one lesson that you have unlearned? And what I mean by that is something that you held to be ironclad truth when you started out the career that you just thought it would be absolutely undeniable truth that you realize later on that it just wasn't the case.
Oh, Jeff, I don't know if I had any kind of undeniable truths, but when you're naive and you come into your first job and you're pretty passionate about it and enthusiastic, is I guess the expectation that everyone is the same in their approach. They all have the kind of the same drive and ambitions, that it's the kind of most important thing in your life. And in reality, that's not the case. For some people, that's not the important thing. You know, not everyone wants to be the star. Not everyone wants to be the manager. Not everyone wants to be the people leader. There are plenty of people who are kind of happy in their place and doing what they're doing. And, for them to feel guilty that they're not more ambitious about their work, or for managers to feel guilty because, they're not defining a path with them, I don't think it's necessarily the right way to play it. I guess that's what I've unlearned, is not to assume that everyone's going to be the same, everyone's going to have the same level of motivation to the things that you're motivated by. So you've got to approach people and issues on the basis that everyone is different in personality and their priorities in life. And that's a good thing. That's a really good thing.
Indeed. None of us fits neatly into any boxes, and that's the way it should be. Thank you so much for your time, Jim. And I certainly feel like you've got a whole entire war chest of stories to tell, and I really appreciate you for sharing that so generously with us.
Lovely to chat with you, Jeff. And maybe I'll write that book one day and I'll give away some real secrets.
I'll be the first to purchase that book.
I'll give you a signed copy.
Appreciate it. And we'll finish on that note. You've been listening to the podcast, 10 Lessons It Took Me 50 Years to Learn, where we dispense wisdom for career, business, and life. Our guest today has been Jim Carroll, sharing the 10 lessons it took him 50 years to learn. This episode is produced by Robert Hossery, sponsored by the Professional Development Forum, which offers insights, community discussions, podcasts, parties, anything you want, anything you need. And the best part, it's all free. You can find them online at www.professionaldevelopmentforum.org. Don't forget to leave us a review or comment. You can even email us at podcast@10lessonslearned.com. That's podcast@10lessonslearned.com. Go ahead and hit that subscribe button so that you don't miss an episode of the only podcast that makes the world a little wiser. Lesson by lesson. Thanks for listening and stay safe, everyone.